My humble salutations at the Divine Lotus Feet. Sai Ram to all.
Sai Ram.
What an auspicious weekend, long awaited. I would like to do a quick introduction to the chief guest, guest speaker we have. Karuna Sarup Munshi. Ms. Karuna Sarup Munshi is gold medalist in MA Philosophy from Anantapur campus. Of Sri Satya Sai University. Four generations of her family has been in close proximity to Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. In her immediate family, there are about 8 members who have studied in various Sai educational institutes. She has come all the way from Toronto, Canada, to spend her weekend with us, and I really request all of you to give a warm welcome. We had a wonderful session with her this afternoon with the young adults, and this is going to be a second session, and I really cannot wait for 2 more sessions that's going to come up tomorrow. I request all of you to give a warm welcome, and Ms. Karuna Sarup Munshi, welcome to the dais.
I offer myself at the lotus feet of the most beautiful one, the birthless, the deathless, the timeless, the perfect incarnation, Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. Revered Swami, respected elders, sisters and brothers, it's a great pleasure to be here with you this evening, because at this very moment, as we are gathered here to recall the glory of the Lord of the Universe, almost 100,000 people right now are waking up in Prashanti Nilayam and streaming into the Sai. I do not know whether it's in the stadium or the Kulwant Hall for the birthday celebration. The avatar is entering the 83rd year of his career on earth. It's a momentous occasion and such a privilege to be alive at this time and to be living in the awareness of his divinity. Bhagwan is the only God I grew up praying to, because I've been living in the awareness of his divinity for the last 39 years, since my very early childhood. And it never ceases to amaze me how grand his glory is, how vast and far-reaching his name and fame is, and it's all propelled by the power of his simple love. I was very blessed because for the last 3 days I've been celebrating his birthday. I'm associated with the Satya Sai School of Canada in Toronto, and every year at the time of his birthday, we have 2 very special celebrations. One of them is called the Human Values Day, and the next one is called the Founders Day. And on the day of Bhagwan's birthday, we observe a holiday in honor of his birthday. So the 2 days preceding his birthday are the biggest celebrations of our school. We just completed our celebration of the 2008 Human Values Day and Founders Day. And for me, having grown up with Swami, it's just awe-inspiring to watch the power and the extent of his message. For instance, for Human Values Day, we have a beeline of people wanting to come and speak at the school and address the children, because anybody and everybody with half a brain has to respond positively to the message of truth, peace, love, right conduct, and nonviolence. It's so organic what Swami teaches us, and his appeal is so universal. And this time, a person who was very keen to come back for a second year in a row was a Catholic priest. His name is Father Terry Gallagher, and he works with the Scarborough Missions in Scarborough, which is a suburb of Toronto where the school is located. And he came to speak to the children, and some of the children presented some songs and dramas before he spoke. And when it was his turn to get up and speak, he said he was unable to speak because he was so moved by the message of love that the children conveyed. He said the message of Satya Sai Baba is so appealing, and it is so heartwarming for him to watch such young children with such innocent hearts understand that it's actually relevant and meaningful to their immediate lives in very simple ways. And he said, you know, your teacher is Satya Sai Baba, and my teacher is Jesus, Lord Jesus Christ. And they both tell us the same teachings. And he said, these are also the teachings of the Buddha. And he said, these are also the teachings of every great incarnation that has ever been on earth. He said, this is what the Quran says as well. There is no difference. And actually, I don't know if you'll believe me, he went to the extent of saying how fortunate he was to be in the school, and there were two young students from grade 6 who were emceeing the show. He turned around and touched their feet. And he said he felt so blessed to be with the children of an educator. He said, your founder is the greatest universal teacher on earth right now, and his teachings are what the world needs to heal itself. He said, starting with each human heart. And for me, as somebody who grew up with Swami, thinking Swami is my mom and dad, and you know, I'll tell you tomorrow all my experiences as a student, when I actually never realized the extent of his divinity, I almost treated Swami like my best buddy. To watch how the world reveres that name and the power of that name, that you utter the name Satya Sai and people are in awe. They know this name stands for the greatest teacher, the most magnanimous humanitarian that has ever lived in the history of humanity, the greatest embodiment of love who has done so much for all of us. And the only thing missing in the entire Sai mission is any kind of publicity. Apart from the celebration at the Satya Sai School, it might interest you to know that from yesterday evening till tomorrow evening, there is an enormous 3-day celebration going on for one of the many centers that are in Toronto. There are many Sai centers in Toronto, very big in size. The one that has operated, one of the earliest, largest centers that has operated for decades at Toronto's York University, has got a home of its own. It's going to be the Sri Satya Sai Center of York, Toronto. I think they'll drop the word York because they're no longer with York University as a venue. Their inauguration has started yesterday. It will go on till tomorrow. And there are 5 different beautiful celebrations going on, and each one, at least 1,000 people are expected to join. This is outside. This is not the largest center in Toronto. So in Toronto right now, as in Chicago, as in every single center across North America, across the world, in every continent, there are Bal Vikas gurus working very hard as we speak. There are cores of volunteers cooking food for all the people who will be attending Bhagwan's birthday. There are children who are practicing their lines, and people with their PPTs and audiovisual. There's lots of people involved in this celebration, and it's then you go to Puttaparthi, you find just about everybody you know there in the darshan line. There are so many people involved, millions of us doing this thing because we are celebrating Swami's birthday. And as momentous as the occasion is, and as fortunate as we are to be living as contemporaries of the avatar, and most importantly, in the awareness of his divinity, this is also a very momentous and important time for questioning ourselves as members of an organization that bears his sacred name. I was listening to a speech by a professor of the Sri Satya Sai University, a visiting professor, who spoke about a very pertinent question. He asked the audience in Bhagwan's immediate presence. I heard the speech over Radio Sai, the recording of it. And in the speech, the professor asked an important question. He said, we should ask ourselves, do we deserve Bhagwan? And subsequently, I heard an important interview between Professor G. Venkatraman of Radio Sai Global Harmony and the head of our organization here, Dr. Michael Goldstein. In that interview, Dr. Michael Goldstein spoke about an important issue. He said, as devotees, we have to understand the difference between spiritual practices and the practice of spirituality. And now, as the avatar is in the final phase of his earthly sojourn, it's high time that each of us decided if we are ready to graduate from the 9-point code of conduct. If each of us does a self audit and we'll go, okay, once a month participate with family in bhajan, check. Once a week satsang in family. Once a month bhajan in center, check. Narayan Seva once a month, check. So if we get all 9 check marks, are we done? Is that enough? That is the tricky question that Dr. Goldstein asked. And I thought that was very interesting, and I wanted to discuss a little bit about that issue with you today. Because we have been doing our soup kitchens, we've all been doing Narayan Seva, we've been spreading ourselves very thin, going for our bhajans. But what we need to do is to look around us and ask ourselves, For what Swami has achieved single-handedly, sitting in a remote corner in a village that was like so obscure and underdeveloped when he was born, that village has today emerged as the world's spiritual capital. And if Bhagwan could do that without any publicity, no promotion, no media blitz, never traveling outside of the country except for one quick brief visit to Uganda when he said he went only in response to the love of a devotee there, Dr. Patel. Other than that, Swami has done no North American tours every summer, no $200 tickets, motivational speaking, nothing. Sitting quietly, the resident of the Yajur Mandir has evoked such love and inspired so many people to live purpose-driven lives. If Bhagwan has achieved that, to what extent have we made spirituality a way of life for ourselves? And to what extent have we taken the light of his message to our fellow countrymen? Do our centers honestly reflect the demographics of our country and our communities? These are some very touchy questions, but I think if we don't address them now and introspect now, we are running out of time, and in no time it might be too late. We all know what we have to do, and we all are committed to Swami, and yet there is a certain degree of reluctance and resistance that prevents us from going that extra mile to take this message mainstream to every heart that is aching. Swami's message is relevant to every walk of our life. Swami says politics without principle, business without commerce, education without character, not only useless but positively dangerous. So the relevance of the five human values completely transcends all boundaries of religion, culture, faith. It is just plain common sense. The greatest universalist is amongst us. He's our teacher. His teachings are like the sunshine. And it is our duty to ensure that everyone we know is inspired to open the blinds of their windows to let this light in. In this context, I'd like to share one little story that Swami says. He says, you know, a lot of us are often, the reason we know what is right and we don't take that leap of faith and go the extra mile to achieve it is because we are so caught up in ourselves. For decades now, I'm sure everybody in this audience will agree with me, we have prayed to Swami for so many worldly boons and blessings and for help in times of difficulties. Swami has done it all. He's given us our jobs, our money, our wealth, our families, our green cards, our visas, whatever we've asked him. Help in every possible way. He gave it, but is that why the avatar really descended? He gave it to us in the hope that one day we'll finally tire of our foolishness and wake up to receive what he truly has come to give us. What has he come to give us? Freedom from worry, freedom from anxiety, a sense of inner happiness where we are always happy, content, and in harmony. If that is the case, you know, if actually Swami's mission actually succeeded to that extent, all the drug makers who make antidepressants would be very, very unhappy because the world would not be popping in the kind of medication and substance abuse that we indulge in to create an artificial sense of happiness. The well of happiness within us, we're refusing to let it unleash. And the reason we are not experiencing that bliss is because we are trapped. We are in a five-fold trap. And this is one of my favorite Chinnakatha stories that Swami tells. He talks of this great emperor. He had lands and he conquered kingdoms and he had great wealth and he was a just ruler, but he wasn't happy at home. Swami said his problem was he had five wives. Most men have trouble handling one wife. Now the king had five queens, and that kind of added to his woes. And when he went to foreign lands on great expeditions, his wives would give him this long list of shopping, of goodies to bring for them. One of them was big into music, so she gave him a long list of stuff. I guess she said, you know, she wants all the latest music. So I don't think they had CDs then, or whatever. She bring me back all the music. The other one was great into books, and she wanted all kinds of literature. There was one queen who was obsessed with great perfumes, so she wanted every latest wonderful perfume that money could buy, and the king was loaded, so he could afford to buy those. After all, he was king. And there was another one who wanted the softest, a most beautiful fabrics to touch. So he had to bring her stuff back. And then, you know, no matter how hard he tried to please each of them, each was jealous of the other, each was trying to get his attention. He was torn between his five wives. His plight was pathetic. And one day he sat thinking and he said, you know, I have it all. The world must think I'm such a happy man, but who knows about my true misery? It's just impossible to handle the five of them. Maybe I should, you know, he was very obviously very progressive-minded and forward-thinking. He decided he should have a little support group. He should learn from like-minded people. He didn't want to live in isolation, obviously a very intelligent king. So he sent out his minister and he said, I want you to go to my entire kingdom and make an announcement that the king has invited every single married male subject to his kingdom. And I'm going to pitch two tents. He had this sprawling palace and it had beautiful balconies overlooking these lovely gardens, and he said, I'm going to pitch two tents to marquees. In one tent, all the men who are afraid of their wives should go into the tent on my right, and all the men who know to control their wives and are not afraid of their wives should go to the tent on my left. So the official minister went around the entire kingdom and this announcement was made that there will be a grand convention of the husbands, the spouses, and the king has called for every man to come and assemble and troop into the designated marquee. So when the appointed day came, the king was so excited. He got up early, got himself freshened up, got the beautiful tiara, the crown on his head, went on the balcony anxious to see if people are beginning to come. Well, slowly the men started to trickle in, and then the trickle became a heavy downpour. Lots of men were pouring in. But strangely, he noticed they were all going in one direction. Wonder which one, huh? And then he said, oh my God, I'm such a failure. All the male subjects in my kingdom are as afraid of their wives as I am, because the tent to my right is completely jam-packed. There's not a single man who went to the tent that is for men who are not afraid of their wives. And he was bemoaning his fate and he said, I've been a horrible role model. Just as I'm such a henpecked husband, I think all my subjects are too. Just then he noticed a lone man walking towards the tent on the left for men who were not afraid of their wives. He said, hooray, alas, there is just one gentleman in my entire kingdom who has the nerve and the guts to go into that, not to be afraid of his wife. I must congratulate this man, I must honor this man, this sole person, this single entity. And he said, please bring him up to me. And this man was brought up and he shook his hands and he said, you know, I really want to richly award you. At least there is one brave heart in my entire kingdom, one man who's not afraid of their wife. The man immediately pleaded. He said, Your Majesty, I must tell you, I went to that tent because my wife told me, when you go there, go to the tent which is for men who are not afraid of their wives. That's the reason I went there. Swami said, most of us are like this king. We have these incredibly annoying five wives, the five senses, that have cast their spell on our minds. And they've taken us over completely. Our desires for appetizing food, for soft fabric, good smell, certain sounds, it's just completely overwhelmed us, and we are forgetting who the boss is here. The boss within you, the mind, is the ruler of your senses. And the Atma, or the self within you, is the ruler of your mind. And what is this self? The self is the infinite Atma. That, Swami says, at no point in time we should forget we are the children of immortality. Amrutasya Putra. Each of us is the child of immortality. And when I say that, I mean we are the soul. That which fire cannot burn, wind cannot blow, water cannot wet, nothing can destroy it, the immortal self. If each of us lived in awareness of our true identity, nothing would snare us, scare us, not even the five senses. We would become the true rulers of ourselves. What is holding us back is this realization that we don't have to set our standards based on what others tell us, what society tell us, what we've been, the conditioning we've been raised with. It's about time. If we have heard one discourse of Bhagwan, and in every single discourse without fail, he addresses us as He always says Divi Atma Swarupa, the embodiment of the divine Atma, or the embodiment of love. That name tag alone should give us the self-confidence to always remember we are God, our nature is to be happy, our nature is to be fearless, and our normal state of being is to be in harmony, to make good choices, not to be in situations of conflict, dissent, disagreement, always unhappiness, looking for faults in others. If we don't get that right now, when the avatar is in his 83rd year, we are calling for very serious trouble. And this is a message that I have repeatedly received from Bhagwan. Growing up with him, I've received so much of grace from him, which I'll be very happy to share with you tomorrow, some instances of it. Yet, I always found myself, you know, being very complacent. Okay, I go to Bhajan, I'm a secretary of a center, I do the youth coordination thing. And I remember in the year about 2000, when the school was being planned, I was one of the volunteers in one of the many subcommittees, because the school was such a huge national project for Canada. There was a lot of hard work that went on for at least a year prior to its start. I was in a small member in one of the smaller committees. My committee was the spiritual awareness committee. Our job was to make sure every time we're going to make a big decision or do something important, we'll do a nice bhajan to evoke Swami's blessing. So, you know, I was in charge of the flowers, the altar, the prasadam. I and five others, we all as a group did that. And I was very happy. I'm doing my bit. I'm serving Swami. Yet every single time I went to that meeting, the voice of God in me told me I had to do more. But then, you know, being my foolish self, I was like listening to my senses. I was like, no, not right now. It's not a good time, especially because I was expecting my son at that time. So really, there was being pregnant has nothing to do with being a little bit more sincere, but that was my excuse. And I was working full time. So, you know, I'm pregnant, I'm working full time. I drive an hour each way to work. Part-time devotion is just enough. Every time when the school was inaugurated, I remember I was the MC for one of the functions, and I was an expectant MC. And I was like, okay, good, my child is getting good vibes and listening to good stuff, but that's it. But whenever I went to school, I heard Swami's voice so clearly in my heart tell me to do something more. So I was like, what more can I possibly do? I'll see. Then I decided, okay, this is what I'll do. I'll have my baby, I'll go on maternity leave, and after maternity leave is over, I'll go back to school and, you know, take up a I'm not a teacher by training. Maybe I'll go to teacher's college, although I wasn't inclined to do that. I was just buying time and making excuses for myself. And I actually ignored Swami so badly. And then Swami decided to teach me the worst lesson of my life ever. He put me through such a difficult situation where I realized how much time I had wasted in my life to do what I was meant to do. Not because Swami needed me, because I needed to do that only for my own self-gratification and growth. And I needed it so badly. And this happened about 2 years after my son was born. One very cold January morning, my husband, my son, and I left Toronto in a big van loaded with all kinds of little starter kits. And we drove down to the U.S., to Massachusetts, because my sister-in-law was flying in from India for the first time ever. She is the wife of my husband's younger brother, and she was flying to US because she had been appointed a teacher in one of the schools in Connecticut board, and this was her first trip out of India. So as family, the only family she has here, we decided we'll go and pick her up and spend the first week with her to get her started in an apartment and everything so she can sign her contract, and then we'd come back. It was a very snowy, blizzardy day, and we drove a journey that should have taken us about 8 hours, took us about 15 hours, but we had to drive very slowly, and I vividly remember I counted about 40 cars were belly up on the strewn along that route of the highway because the roads were treacherously slippery. So we drove down to this little town called Amherst, Massachusetts. That's where, just as I'm staying with Madhu Didi here, I had a friend from Anandpur College, another alumna, Malika. We stayed in her house because she said we could stay with her, pick up my sister-in-law, get her settled in Hartford where she was getting a job. So we would go up and down an hour each day, and then after a week, we would go back home. So on a very bad weather day, I chanted like Gayatri for those 15 hours, and I had such heartburns, and both Sunny and I were drinking Maalox and driving away with the two-year-old son of ours because I couldn't leave him back at home. He wouldn't stay without me. And I had my daughter is 10 years older. I had a 12-year-old daughter and a mother-in-law and a sister in Toronto. I reached there, I don't know, 2 a.m., and we went to bed, and next day my sister-in-law was arriving. So my husband said, this drive has been so traumatic and the roads are so bad. Let me go early to the airport, and I'll drive to Boston. You stay with the baby and relax, and I'll come back with our sister-in-law. All good, so we had a late breakfast, and he went to the airport, and he went maybe at 9:30, 10 in the morning, and my sister-in-law's flight was coming at 5 or 6. And we waited for them to come back. So at about 7 in the evening, when I was expecting both of them to arrive home, my sister-in-law calls. And I said, oh, hi, you reached? And she said, yes, but how come you guys never came to pick me? I said, oh, no, Sunny is gone in the morning. He's there. Just look for him. She said, no, I've been waiting at the airport for the longest time and there is nobody to pick me. And this was her first time in winter. She didn't have proper winter gear. First time traveling outside India and the second time she ever took a flight in her life. So it was a very big step and we were supposed to be there to, you know, give her moral support. And my husband had just disappeared. So I said, no, it must be because he's at the wrong terminal. Call him on his cell phone. And I'm calling my husband on my cell phone. And no reply. So initially I didn't panic and I said, yeah, he must be around. Don't worry. Don't panic. Stay where you are. I'll try and reach him. We tried everything. Nothing worked. Several hours passed and a person with a BlackBerry and 100 IDs in his pocket and a big car, a big 7-seater van, just disappeared from the face of earth. 2-3 hours, my poor sister-in-law waited. I don't know which security guard from she borrowed the cell phone from and kept calling me. After a while, panic set in. Because the roads were so bad and it was snowing so heavily and I was staying in somebody else's house with the little baby, I called home in Ontario. Now I started imagining the worst, but initially I kept my cool. I went to Swami's altar and I prayed and I said, whatever it is, please, you're in charge of the situation, Swami. It's really making me very, very unhappy because poor thing, she was waiting at an airport. Nobody, you travel across the ocean and you come here and there's nobody to pick you. After about 6-7 hours, this person is completely missing, no response on his cell phone. Then our panic button started to go off. So I started to call all the hospitals and the police stations to know if an Ontario van had been involved in any accident because it was very snowy and the roads were wet and bad and he was new to the city and he was using a GPS, but there was a lot of construction near Boston Airport, so, you know, something might have happened. I had no trace of my husband. I called home in Toronto to ask if, because he had an Ontario license plate, perhaps the police called my house in Ontario, in Toronto. No response. By now, my mother-in-law is in a state of complete panic. She's crying in front of Swami, and I didn't want to talk because I was trying to stay calm, and I had this little baby. And so my friend's husband and his friends decided they would maybe make a search party and go, but it's a long drive, like 100-something kilometers. Where would they find him? At this time, all of a sudden, it dawned on me that my life's worst fears were coming true. And life as I had known was just beginning to unravel in front of my very eyes. It was a fear that I had never experienced ever in my life. It was awful. And I went down to Swami's altar. My friend has an altar like Madhu has in her basement. All Anandpur girls have an altar in their basement, I guess. It's something we learned at college. So she has a center in her house. And I went down and I didn't know what to do next. And I asked Swami, because it was a fear I had never experienced before and I just didn't know how to react or respond to it. And my situation was very desperate because I was dependent on somebody else with a 2-year-old. Half the family was in Canada and there's a missing person. My best friend in life after Swami just went missing on me. And I went down to the altar and I asked Swami, I said, let me step back and review this situation. What am I supposed to do? Where am I supposed to find this missing person? And what? And of course, I had to send a search party to bring my sister-in-law back. At that time, I remembered Swami says, God is inside you, within you, without you, around you, everywhere. It's like the relationship of fish to water. So I said, even in this agony, this extreme moment of fear, when I'm just paralyzed by fear, Swami is with me. Swami, is there something I'm missing in this situation? And right away I realized, I was missing something. I was desperate. I was desperate for this horrible nightmare to go away. I was desperate for the clock to go back to 9:30 when I had seen my husband healthy and fine next to me. I was desperate to just make it undo everything that was happening to me. I just was not prepared for it. And at that time, I said to Swami, "Swami, I will give you an arm and a leg. I'll do anything. Just make it go away, this nightmare, please." And I realized, did Swami need my arm or a leg? Why? He's not a carnivore. What would he do with it? Then I realized, am I missing a lesson? And it came to me that Swami has repeatedly given me so many chances to grow and serve him. And I have missed every single chance. And I should give him a promise that as long as I live, I will live in accordance with his teachings. And I decided that was my turning point, my deciding moment. And I said to Swami, "Swami, I think I have really goofed up my life. I've messed up every minute of it. I've been busy making money, you know, having a good life, doing my part-time Sai Baba work. And if you make this moment go away, then you have my word that I will live only for you and you alone." And at the moment I made that prayer, and I got her from the altar, I got a phone call, and they found this missing person after like 9 hours. And it was such a comedy of errors how those two of them missed each other. But in any case, they came home 2.5 hours later. I was so relieved he was okay. But then when he came, I was waiting on the stairs to get him. That's the story I'm not going to share right now. So my husband, he left his cell phone in the parking lot in the glove compartment of the car. That's why it was going to voicemail, duh. And he goes to look for his sister-in-law and she goes to look for him. I don't know which terminal. In the end, I think the whole series of events was orchestrated to send me to shock therapy and shake me up and make me realize what a wasted life I was living and how I was embroiled and so self-obsessed. And I needed that waking up. I needed that severe knock on my head. And Swami had given me that message many, many times till that day. However, when you don't imbibe a lesson that is given to you by God, the lesson will be repeated and the test will be repeated. And it was repeated to me in the form of this shock therapy. I came back and I made a phone call to the principal of the school at that time, Mr. T.R. Pillay, the founding principal who had an enormous role to play in setting up this magnificent school, a total true visionary, a great educator. And I called him and I said, "Mr. Pillay, I think we need to meet." And he said, "Why?" I said, "I need to discuss employment opportunities with you." He said, he was pretty shocked. And he said, "Sure, come along." He was very suspicious. He said, "Why this change of mind?" And I told him it was an inner calling. It's an inner calling that I have neglected. Each of us has our inner calling. And yet we don't want to step out of that little square of our own securities. We don't want to shed our securities and step out of them and actually live the life we are meant to live. And I realized for me, deciding to take up this position, and actually they didn't even know what to do with me because they didn't think I was qualified enough to really do much in a school, which is true. But then he said, "What do you see yourself doing?" So I had to create a job for myself. I said, "Community outreach. I can teach kids. I can set up a library. Whatever you say, I'll do one-on-one teaching. But I think Swami wants me to do this, and I promised him, and I will do that." And that's how my full-time association with the school began. Till then, I was a volunteer. But the point I'm trying to make is that each of us has to infinitely resign to his will and take that leap of faith. Till we do that, our devotion to him is entirely part-time. For me, to give up the security of a very well-paying job, great benefits, good pension plan, the security of the familiarity of the situation was a huge leap. I remember even to leave my son, who was 2, for in daycare was very tremendously hard for me because I couldn't tear myself from him. Ever since he was born, I had been home with him. And one fine day, I decided to go to work and send him to the daycare. And it's funny because the daycare, which is near my house, is attached to an elementary school, which is right across from a temple just like this called the Sanatan Mandir. And I used to go with him in the stroller for a walk in the summertime and take him to the mandir. And just like this temple, it has a huge hall entirely carpeted. There is not even a marble aisle in the middle. So my son, being two, terrible two, he used to love playing there because it was a nice open space. And when we sent him to daycare, he was so distraught. He feared it so much that every morning we'd go to the parking lot. He used to say, no, no, I'll go and spend the day with Mata Rani in the temple. I'll play with her. I'll pray to her, but I won't go to daycare. And it was very, very hard. But I realized when you do God's work, God really takes over all your responsibilities and work. And that has proven so true for me every moment. After I decided to ensure that every dot that Swami taught me, every I that Swami taught me to dot and every T to cross, I'm going to use it only to glorify the Lord of my life who has filled me with such joy. I'm going to use it to share this message with as many people as I possibly can, as lovingly as I possibly can, not because he needs that, because I need to do it for me. I need to do it for my redemption. Swami needs nobody. If he could create this universe by the power of a single thought, it doesn't need millions of us to do nothing for him. These are all opportunities, employment opportunities created for our inner growth. And when I did what my soul, when I responded to my soul call, I realized my life became so easy. My problems and tensions became entirely his responsibility. I have never had it this easy. I have never lived a life this good. I have never enjoyed such holidays. I have never had all my problems get solved like this in a trice. I can give you an instance. The Satyasai School is a very demanding job which I created for myself. This, I don't hold any position. I'm just an assistant in the office. There's so much to do and it's so invigorating and spiritually nourishing. You just can't get enough of it and it just sucks you in and you enjoy doing it. But sometimes the guilt just gnaws at me. And I, when my daughter was in grade 8 and it was really bothering me, I had done no research for her high school and she wanted to go to an IB program and I hadn't found out which was the best school, didn't attend open houses because I'm perpetually in the school. Those days more than I am now. I was just praying to Swami, what should I do? And next thing you know, a person walks into the office and she's talking to the principal at that time, Mr. Pillay. And when he introduced us, we realized we were next door neighbors. We were both Sai devotees. I had never met her before. Her name is Varitha. She's a very dear friend of mine now. And her two kids were just, one was a year older than mine and the other was 2 years older than mine. And they had already taken the route. So I had to do nothing. I had to attend no open house. She had done all the research. She just gave me the distilled information, set me up, and everything was through. Even the littlest of my, sometimes I have a severe cold and I'm like, I will step out, go to Costco, get cold FX because I'm miserable. But I don't have that moment, that window of opportunity to draw. Costco is exactly 2 minutes from my workplace. I never find that window of opportunity to go park, go in, buy, pay, come back, because the whole trip will take me at least 20 minutes. Just when I'm thinking, somebody leaves a cold FX bottle on my desk. How compassionate, the tiniest of things. When we take one step towards the Lord of Puttaparthi, he overwhelms us with joy. Swami has fulfilled each of my wishes beyond my wildest capacity. There is nothing in this universe I can ever do to repay my debt to him. And I mean it from the bottom of my heart. As we celebrate his 83rd birthday, each of us really needs to see how many people have I positively influenced by practicing his teachings. And that mission has to begin with ourselves. We have to be kinder and gentler to ourselves, more accepting, more forgiving, less critical. We all have issues with the mistakes of the past. But Swami says, past is gone. It's beyond recovery. Live in the present moment. From this very moment onwards, if we practice the 5 human values, our attitude to life has to change. And it has to begin with all the people in our immediate life, especially the difficult ones. Whether it's our co-workers or our in-laws or our spouses or our teenage children, we have to practice all of these values with our immediate selves, immediate circle of friends, our co-workers, and our community. And when we do that, we will realize that God does not have, Sai devotees do not all have to be people who look like me, who come from the same background, who have similar ideas and faiths. And I think that is a flaw we seem to be, that is a little area that needs a lot of attention, because we seem to overlook the fact that Swami's message is for everyone. It is universal. It is not bound to any one faith. It is based on the timeless and eternal principles of Sanatana Dharma, which are a way of life. The Sanatana Dharma is a way of life which tells us to live in harmony with ourselves, everyone else, including the environment. We don't need Al Gore to tell us. I love his film, The Inconvenient Truth. But if you follow Sanatana Dharma, you don't need Inconvenient Truth to make you environmentally aware. It's all there. The practice of right conduct and non-violence prevent us from doing anything harmful to the environment. Wasting, the program Sealing on Desires, it gives us a perfect way of life to live our lives in complete sync with Swami's teachings. I just want to share one little story with you, and I think my time is over. At the Satya Sai School, the school is open to people of all faiths and races, regardless of their belief in Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba's divinity or not. The only thing they're looking for is there's a very elaborate admissions process. It begins with an open house and there is an interview process. As long as the vision and the values of the family match ours, the values that we propagate as part of a character education program based on the Satya Sai education and human values, we are open to accepting those children. In this process, we have several students who come from a non-South Asian background. They come from various churches, and what happened is when one kid came, there was such an improvement in his character that he became the talk of the whole church congregation, and more kids started to apply for admission from that church group. And there is one child who joined us in grade 2. Prior to that, he used to go to a public school because he has very unfortunate family circumstances, he was very disturbed and he had a lot of difficulty learning. And in the public school system, they had just stereotyped him as a difficult kid and he was highly neglected. When he joined our school, he really came a long way, but still you cannot change a kid overnight. So there were many times he had his shirt would be untucked, his shoes, his laces would be undone, and he would be in a state of dishevel. That's a lot of time. Okay, thank you. This child would be in a state of disarray because our children look very sharp and smart because they wear very beautiful uniforms. Nice gray dress pants for boys, sharp looking white long sleeve shirts, navy blue sweaters with the big beautiful crest which says Human Excellence, Satya Sai School of Canada and the Five Human Values, and ties for boys. Very, very nice. But this kid looked like so shabby, and because he was very disruptive in his behavior and he had other learning disabilities, he required a lot of one-on-one attention. Always, every 2 minutes, he had to go to bathroom, which is a typical sign of ADHD, water breaks, this, that. So, but if you ever asked him, so how is your day going? Great. When he had his first day at our school, I asked him, so how was the first day? He said, it was wonderful. And I saw him like, I thought, ooh, this doesn't seem like a wonderful day. He was all over the place. I said, did you make any friends? He said, yeah. I said, how many? He said, the whole class. Everybody was very nice to me. So I was very happy for him. But he's not a typical Satya Sai school student. Now we have an elderly gentleman, a volunteer, who's about my dad's age. From the day this school was started, he reports for work like a paid employee, early in the morning, dressed in white and white, ready to serve Swami. He calls himself Lord Hanuman because he wants to serve Swami like Hanuman served Rama. And he enters, and every time you ask him, so uncle, how are you? Excellent. Happy to be alive, happy to be serving my Lord. He's the most positive person I've ever met. And he does all kinds of work around the school, photocopying. Him and I do all the cleaning when children throw up or have accidents. He takes care of the little boys, I take care of the little girls. Anything goes wrong in the bathroom, plumbing, he does all those kinds of jobs along with me. I love having him there because he's really very helpful. And when there is no work, he sits quietly by the front door like a security guard writing Om Shri Sai Ram in his notebook. The nicest person you can ever meet, the truest Sai devotee. But one day he came to my office and he said, you know, I need to talk to you. And he was like, I'm not happy with anybody here. And he was like, you know, when we don't want to backbite, we just make eyes. And he was pointing to the principal or the teachers. I said, why, uncle? What happened? How can they take children like him? This is Swami's school. How can you take a child who has no manners? His nose is running, his shirt is untucked, he's always walking around, loitering down the corridor. Every 2 minutes he needs water, and he's coughing, and he's not tidy, and his laces are undone, and he's so disruptive, and he's scratching his head when a special guest is speaking, and so on. So I said, Uncle, why don't you sit down? And I just sat him down and I explained to him the circumstances of this child at home. And by the time I was done, I had this uncle who was so angry. He said, this school belongs to people who believe in Swami and his values. He doesn't belong here. When I told him where this kid was coming, what his home environment was like, what the state of acute dysfunction in his family was, he was crying. And that day I said, Uncle, do you really believe that Swami's message and Swami's education, this child doesn't deserve? Who needs it more than him? All the other kids who come from stable homes with professional parents, nice income, good home, nice car, 5 sports activities, they need it more, or this child needs it more? And he said, no, for the first time I realized this, because he was totally dead against this idea of non-devotee people coming and all that. Although it was very cute, because one day he asked this little boy's sister, he said, Chrissy Ann, come here, tell me, who is this? And she goes, oh, he's a founder, Sachi Sai Baba, I love him. And I said, oh, thank God. And now he's not going to be mad, fire her and send her out. Then I said, now you know why the principal and the teachers accepted this child, because Swami's teachings, this child needs the love more. And his parents, despite all the dysfunction in his family, they never fail to come separately, because they don't co-inhabit. They come to individually thank us for the love this child has received in this school, the sense of dignity and self-worth he has acquired, the sense of acceptance from his peers, although he is lagging so far behind academically. And that is something we all really, really need to keep in mind when we decide to take this message to the community. And Auntie here had asked me to talk about the Walk for Values, and I see that I have some time. I would be very happy to talk about that. At the Sathya Sai School, I think Swami told me to join that school only because he wanted to fill me with bliss. There was no other reason. And I just thought bliss was making good money and having a good job. Because, like the king, I was so deluded by the 5 wives in my own life. And as a young girl, when I grew up and I took every word that Swami spoke, and I was so anxious. I wanted the whole world to know his message. I wanted to see the Sai movement go mainstream. I wanted Swami on 2020 and on Larry King Live, so that everybody would find out that God is on earth and he has such a simple formula to solve every single problem on this earth. Guys, just wake up and listen to what he has to say. But then I used to go home to, my family, and other than my immediate family and my grandparents, even if I told my cousins, on Swami gave us saris and he gave us this example, and they're like, yeah, okay. So, because, we were not on the same page. Everybody is going to grow into Sai awareness in their own time. And because I was such an anxious teenager, I guess my angst was driving me nuts. But by the time Swami enrolled me in the Sathya Sai school, I think he realized I needed some basic, a course correction in my fundamental understanding of his message and his mission. And in that connection, he enrolled me in an elementary school. I really have done nothing that connects my job profile to working in an elementary school. And because I had these aspirations to see his message go mainstream, he got me involved with the Walk for Values. Walk for Values was born because the parents of the Sathya Sai School in the first 2 years were so happy with what the children were bringing back home and the improvement in their home environment, because they had just 1 or 2 kids going to the Sathya Sai School, that they wanted to thank the school. So they came and met the principal, Mr. Pillai, and said, we'd like to do something. Can we do a fundraiser? So Mr. Pillai said, we don't have, our guidelines don't allow us to solicit funds and do those kinds of, jam and bake sale and all that. But you can always express your gratitude in non-monetary ways. They said, how? He said, raise the awareness about the school. And that's how the idea for Walk for Values was born. So they said, okay, we're going to showcase this school in the community, and we will create awareness about these five human values, because these five human values, after our children started to practice them, they have brought about a very positive change in our lives, in our homes by extension, because these children have come back, they're less argumentative, less TV, more responsible, more conscientious, and that has really affected so many children. One little boy went home and his mom was getting all upset, and she wanted to give him one, you know, just spank him, and he just held his mom's hand and he said, "Mom, hands are for helping, not for hurting." And I remember when my son, who studies at the Satisai School, when he was in JK, one day he was running behind his sister, who's 10 years older and is scared of him sometimes because he's such a terror. He ran down the upstairs stairs and he was about to follow her to the downstairs stairs because she was screaming, "Save me!" I mean, she can be quite a drama queen too. So he was behind her and he had his hand held out like this. So I saw it from the kitchen and I hid behind the wall. As soon as he went past me, I held his hand. I said, "Excuse me, which value do you think you're practicing?" And my three-year-old says spontaneously, "Non-loving." So the awareness is there that he wasn't practicing love, he was practicing non-loving. So the parents just wanted to, they said, "Oh, okay, we'll tell the community that really your lives will positively improve if you also practice these five values." So we decided to have a walkathon, and instead of a typical walkathon where you're raising money for a good cause, we decided we wanted to raise human consciousness. And it was all divinely inspired by Bhagwan himself. Each person who came up with the idea added to the whole concept. And I think Swami was thinking and speaking through each one of them. And there's a whole lot of teamwork that was involved by some amazingly dedicated Sai devotees and the parent council of the Satya Sai School. They worked very closely. So over the years, it has evolved into a huge, humongous celebration of the five human values. And about 5,000 to 6,000 people come into downtown Toronto, into the core of Toronto City by Eaton Centre. There is an open area called the Dundas Square. We rent it from the City of Toronto. And I could tell you a million different stories, but we will be way past 6:55 if I do so, about how happy the city is to have us and what they have to say about us. We want the Sai Babas to come every single year. When you leave Dundas Square and 6,000 people leave, the square is cleaner than we give you. Because Seva Dal, right? We pick up even before somebody's littering, we catch the litter mid-air and we put it in the garbage bin. And we have never had a function this beautifully organized, so disciplined. And then the manager of Dundas Square phoned and called us and said, "You know those big banners you have? We have, I wish I didn't bring any Walk for Values pictures with me. I didn't realize I'd be talking about it. But if you go to our website, walkforvalues.com, you can see the picture. There's a huge stage in the back of Dundas Square. It's very high, and we have invested a lot of money in creating big banners that carry Swami's universal message. Help, ever hurt, never, and so on, Satya Sai Baba. So, and then we displayed it all around the square. And she called and said, "Next year, can you display them a little bit higher so that more, the visibility will be better because the world needs to hear Sai Baba's message." And in the initial year, we did it in the Scarborough, a suburb called Scarborough, where the school is located. And I remember because you have to have a lot of police clearance and permits to block the road and divert the traffic, whenever the community outreach officer from Ontario Provincial Police came to visit us, one time they told us, "Next year, can you slightly change your route and go through a particular community called Melbourne?" And we said, "Why?" They said, "You know, we have had a huge drug crackdown there and we have arrested a lot of young people and those families are hurting badly and they are very upset with the police because their children have been taken away. I think they need Sai Baba's message of forgiveness and compassion." That was the police force telling us to take the walk there. So because when we walk, we carry all these banners and flags and we seek pledges. But these are non-monetary pledges. We ask every person to indulge in a little bit of self-audit, self-introspection, and find an area of personal weakness. I go to speak at various centers before every Walk for Values to inspire people to come out and join us and tell them the significance. And I'm sorry, but it's a racist joke, but I always say, all people from the Indian subcontinent, punctuality is the value you're all going to practice, because we tend to run so behind time because nobody should arrive late at the Walk for Values. the youth love it because, you know, they're always running like an hour and a half late behind everything with their parents. So because we cannot be late at the walk for values. So, you know, if you're impatient, you would practice patience. It can be any value: forgiveness, compassion, volunteering, acceptance, gratitude, love, whatever, self-esteem, self-confidence, whatever the area that requires. So we have listed, like, we have created this enormous list of sub-values. It's all in EHV. It's all there. All of your teachers, I'm sure you're well acquainted with it. Not just the five human values. The five major human values, like, and a zillion sub-values under each of them. And everybody picks their value, and they wear a huge label on their T-shirt, and you have to spell out the value you're going to practice, and you walk to promote awareness about this value. For the last walk, we had two of Toronto's major leading radio stations parked on the location, broadcasting their music, Easy Rock and another channel, CHFI. And actually, when we did a pre-walk promo, we go to the location with a little thing, little stage, and our microphone, and our piano, and our teachers, and we take our choir, the Voices for Peace, neatly dressed in uniforms, and we sing our value songs, and we hand out flyers and tell everybody. Is the busiest intersection in Toronto. Every 2 seconds, 100 people are crossing that intersection, and we give out leaflets and tell them, come and walk with us for peace. Come and walk with, do you care for the environment? Please walk with us. We are here to protect the planet, protect ourselves, promote awareness for the need to practice these values. And the response is tremendous from the tourists, from the cab drivers, from shoppers, from people who work in that area. And we have a lot of people who have no knowledge of Swami come and join us at this walk. And we give them all the information, all our official websites. I'm very particular about making sure that when you direct people to information about Swami, the websites you give are safe, secure, and reliable. The official websites of the Sai organization are flawless. They are the only source that should ever be given to anybody. So whenever people ask us, where can I get more information about where you guys are coming? SathyaSaiSchoolofCanada.ca. Go to SathyaSai.org. That is the official website of our international organization, and RadioSai.org. Only three websites, or our Canadian, satyasai.ca, our Canadian official website. Don't tell them to go and Google search Swami. Give them the correct addresses. And when we do that, we have people then email on the website on Walk for Values. The webmaster receives so many emails. I loved what you guys do. We are a bunch of retired teachers, and we were passing by, and what we saw, this is what the system in education needs. We had a public school principal just walking by with his wife, and he came to study our model. The kind of awareness it has created. Then we walked through the downtown core. We have, first year we had one mother float, and we had children singing, our choir singing on it, and we had the five human values displayed. But over the years, there's such immensely growing enthusiasm amongst the volunteers that the number of floats has grown. We have one for truth, one for love, and the mother float. And we have different smaller kids with little flags singing value songs. We have a karaoke kind of singing thing. It's a lot of work. It's months of preparation by volunteers and parents, but it's so worth it. And the opening and closing ceremonies, initially we had to look for politicians and community leaders to come. Now everybody who wants to have a nice public persona wants to be associated with the Walk for Values, because it stands for everything positive, because it stands for the message of the most positive, brilliant light that is right now on the face of Earth. Nothing before and nothing after can match this. To live at this moment in history is the greatest blessing. Our souls must have aspired for this over God knows how many lifetimes to be at this moment. And if we cannot actually serve this Lord with wholeheartedly doing everything that he expects of us, I think we are truly failing ourselves. He needs nobody. We need to do it for us. And we need to do it with a sense of urgency and open our hearts to embrace everybody. Swami's message doesn't say only people of certain age group, cultural background, faith, and belief system are welcome. It is open to all. And what are we doing? That's why our movement doesn't seem to... We have to introspect and find every practice that can intimidate somebody who's not born in our background, our cultural background. We have to keep the appeal universal. And we have to take his message with such gusto and confidence. I think everything begins... Swami says all spiritual journeys begin with self-confidence. We forget that so easily. That self-confidence is required even in our faith in Swami and how we project it, how we convey it. And given the society we live in, it has to be in the language, the presentation has to be appropriate for the audience we have. And I think that's where we really, this is the 83rd birthday. Time is running out. Many of us have great physical proximity with Swami. Even having that coveted piece of real estate on the darshan ground is no guarantee for nothing. Come 2020, where are we going to go running to ask Swami, Swami, should we do this? Should we start our center? Unless we develop the inner bond so strongly and realize each of us is Swami, and Swami thinks through me, and Swami will speak through me, and Swami will guide through me, all I have to do is surrender my ego. That's all. That's the beginning and end of the story. Ego, erase it, surrender, let it flow. That is true flow dreaming. That is true manifestation. Manifest the divinity that is within us. When we step forward with that confidence, everybody we touch must turn around and ask, where are you coming from? What makes you so good? And then tell him, it's all him. And when you point to him, you have done him justice. We're all sitting on these ticking time bombs. Time is really running out. And if we don't get our act together now, post-2020, we can do all we want. We can roll ourselves on the ground and cry and seek his forgiveness. It will be too late. I think I've said enough. Thank you for the opportunity, Sairam.